This is episode 43 of the Fifth Estate podcast. The Fifth Estate turns one.
Hi there, Fifth Estate fans. Neil Doing here with an important message for you from our friends at Simply Safe. When you order your Simply Safe home security system online, you're taking the first easy step to protecting your home and family. With entry sensors, motion sensors, and glass break sensors, soon you'll make your home a burglar's worst nightmare, and you'll be done in under an hour. Simply Safe comes pre-programmed to work out of the box. Just plug in the base station, and it'll talk you through the whole process. Seriously, even someone who isn't the slightest bit handy can install it. The entire system is wireless, so there's no need to drill holes in your walls or do other permanent damage. And once you're all set up, Simply Safe makes it just as easy to stay protected month to month. There are no long-term contracts, no hidden fees, and it's just $14.99 a month for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week professional monitoring and emergency dispatch service. Don't wait another day to take your home safety into your own hands. Get Simply Safe. Go to simplysafe.com/ricochet right now to get 10% off your home security system. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. Go now, simplysafe.com/ricochet.
Sing it, Neil.
Say it's your birthday.
I don't know the words.
We're gonna have a good time.
But I do appreciate the sentiment.
Happy birthday to you.
All right. Yes, it is the Fifth Estate. I am Jay Caruso here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Doing. How are you, sir?
I am actually having a fantastic day.
Wow.
Mr. Jay Caruso, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. I am doing very well. Thank you. So
we're both doing great.
Yes.
This is awesome.
It is.
I'm like super pumped.
Me too. Actually, it is kind of fun. A year has gone by. We started this podcast a year ago.
Crazy.
And like we've had like lots of like cool people on here, and now we're like,
again, crazy. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah,
I mean, we've talked to, you know, a ton of just very interesting people who were kind enough to come hang out with us, and never anticipated
that
we'd be able to talk to those kind of people.
No, I mean, and now we're doing ads and stuff like that, and we've got lots of subscribers and really great listeners who.
Yeah,
that's interesting. We're
pretty
stuff.
Much, I would say in the 1%. And when it comes to podcasts, I mean, if you consider that most podcasts don't ever go past maybe 3 or 4 episodes.
Yeah. Yep.
So
yeah, we're doing pretty good. This is 43. Yeah, 43 episodes.
Not too shabby.
Not too shabby. And we, like I said, we've had some great guests. Just some, you know, and it's funny because we have some questions related to that and. You know, we've done such a variety of different shows. I mean, everything from politics to wine and art, you know, to movie reviews. I mean, you name it, video games. I mean, it's like we've had a smorgasbord, and it's been fun.
Yeah, overall, fun. I mean, that's the thing that I've taken away from this past year is that it's been more fun than it has been work, and I really like that.
Yes,
that equation.
Yeah. So it has been. It's always been fun, and I people have asked me, and this is even a question that we got, I don't think, but people have asked, you know, like, who was your favorite guest? And it's hard to pin that down because so many different guests had different things that we talked about. It wasn't like, you can't compare our friend like Amy Otto to, you know, Mike Rowe, because there were two completely different discussions. One was about, you know, the workforce and, you know, what makes you happy. And another one was about wine. So it's kind of like, you can't sit there and say, well, this one was better than that one, because it's so different.
Well, in the sense also that we were always, and that we do always, talk to people we want to talk to about things that we want to talk about and that we hope our listeners want to hear about. I have a great time just about every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, I'll amend that statement. I have a great time every time.
Yeah. I mean, we've had, you know, we've had people on to talk about etiquette. You know, we got a lot of flack when we had Scotty Hughes on, who is a big time Trump supporter.
But hey, you know, it's our show. We'll talk to whoever we want to talk to.
Exactly.
And quite frankly, I feel like talking to someone we disagree with on something like that benefits us, benefits them, maybe benefits the people listening in.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I love about our show, and we're not bragging here, it's just like, you know, we're kind of talking about personally from perspective, what are the things that I like, is the conversational tone that we've had. And I think there's been some guests who didn't really get that at like the first, like maybe 15 minutes they were on. And then they understood, oh, this isn't like a question and answer thing. This is, hey, let's talk about this. I think James Rosen was probably one of the biggest examples of that. When we first started talking to James, you know, he's kind of given us the yearbook answers on stuff that he's about the book, about A Torch Kept Lit that he wrote, the collection of eulogies by William F. Buckley. And then after a while, he seemed to realize, oh, okay, this is not just your typical Q&A. This is more, and then he asked us at one point, do you have time for me to tell another story? And it was like, you know, he got it. He understood that's what we were trying to do.
Sure. And, you know, and one of the other great things about this show is we've had a lot of media professionals on, a lot of political professionals on, but we've also had normal people, for lack of a better term, people who are experts in their field or who know what they're talking about, but aren't necessarily out front and, you know, out in front of a camera or behind a microphone all the time. And I think that we've been able to sort of draw them out too, and present them in a way that makes them feel comfortable. So, I mean, pats on the back all around, Jay. We've done a hell of a job.
Yeah, we have. I'm not
trying to, you know, get a big head here, but I think we've got something pretty good going.
We've done some good stuff, and I think that, you know, even though the guests we've had sometimes they're on a different political spectrum, it doesn't really matter. You know, Kelly Aucoin, the actor who was in Billions, he plays Dollar Bill Stern. If you watch The Americans, he plays the pastor with his wig on and everything. He's in two really cool TV series, and he's on. And if you see him on Twitter, he's very liberal. He was a Hillary supporter, but we had him on to talk about acting. We didn't have him on to talk about politics. And so we had a great conversation with a guy whose politics doesn't match up with ours at all.
It's true. Now I'm Facebook friends with him. So
yeah,
you know,
there you go.
It's fun.
It's like we're Facebook friends. Yeah. And he says, we're in New York, we're going to hang out. So it's kind of like, you know, that's what's so great about that kind of thing. If you don't let politics rule your life, then you can be friends with almost anybody.
Yeah, it's true.
And talk to anybody.
One of my favorite moments from the past year, I think, was when Bill Kristol blamed me for Donald Trump within about the first 2 minutes of the podcast.
He did.
Which I took that to heart. I internalized that blame, and I tried to amend my life.
Well, that's good. It's funny when you think about it. The first episode that we had was with National Review editor, online editor, Charles Cook. And, you know, Trump wasn't even a nominee at that point. And we were still talking about it as though he may not get the nomination at that time. It was a whole bunch of ifs.
It's true. And sometimes I still can't quite believe it. But we also, I think we offered sort of a relief valve you know, for people who were absolutely just fed up with politics, because that's kind of what we were.
Yeah.
Fed up with the daily grind of this endless primary and this long, slow march to oblivion. And so let's talk about something else. Let's talk about art. Let's talk about wine. Let's talk about, you know, what it's like to be a writer, what it takes to be a reporter, you know, what goes into that actual job. And so we've had some fantastic guests who I think taught us a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had, you know, 2 weeks in a row, we had two writers on the show. We had a reporter in Betsy Woodruff from the Daily Beast. And then we had Kevin Williamson, who is more of an opinion journalist. But we didn't talk to them necessarily about politics too much. It was more about their craft and what they do and, you know, how they do it and everything like that. And, of course, you know, one of the biggest things we got out of both of them is that both of them said, don't go to journalism school. You know, I think Betsy had said, if you're going to go to school, pick something where you can be an expert in it. And if you want to write about it, then you can do it. But don't go to journalism school. Her and Kevin both said that because they said that the journalism is consistently changing, that by the time what you learn when you're there, by the time you get out, it's completely different.
That's the truth. We've had a ton of very interesting guests, but you know, Jay, I want to turn the attention away from them for a little while and talk about the other important people in this relationship. And that's our listeners.
Yes.
And we have been so pleased with the positive response that we've gotten to what we're doing, the kind words that people have sent our way. We've also appreciated the criticism that we've received. It helps us get better. We appreciate every review and rating that we get. We really enjoy seeing those. It lets us know that we're actually resonating and you feel strongly enough that you're going to go ahead and tell the world about it, or at least the iTunes review people. So we do appreciate our listeners. We do appreciate our listeners. And that's why for this first birthday edition of The Fifth Estate, we gave our listeners a chance to interview us.
Yeah, we did this one other time, but this time we've got a lot more questions than we did the first time we did it. I think it's probably going to have a lot more listeners, too.
And frankly, I think we're a lot more interesting now than we were back then. We've been through so many experiences.
Yes.
Grown so much as people and as entertainers.
Perhaps.
So, you want to dip into the mailbag there, Jay?
Yes. Yeah, we got a bunch of questions. We'll start with questions that we got via email. We'll go through those first. And Rana McNamara. Who is a regular listener, and I know her on Twitter, and she's a fine person. She asks, as a result of your podcast, do you ever get abuse or anger from friends or family who disagree with you politically? If so, how do you deal with it? Now, I don't have a very big family. My mother passed away. My father's passed away. My brother, who is a liberal, I don't know if he listens to the show. He's never really said anything about it, so I'm almost assuming maybe he doesn't listen to it. But as far as anger or friend, no, you know, it's funny. I get more of, and again, this goes back to, like, you know, when I told people that we were going to have Mike Rowe on our podcast, people were just like freaking out. They didn't really care. They're just like, whoa, Mike, you know, it was more like that. It was like, that's so cool. It's been more about how cool it is that we have certain people on the show as opposed to what we actually talk about.
Or the flip side, the negative impression of that is, how did you guys get that?
Yeah, exactly. How did you manage that?
No offense, but...
yeah. No offense, but you're like a nobody. How did you get him to be on the show?
And the secret is asking politely, people.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for something like that, and that's not a question that we got, but if you have your own podcast and you're concerned about how do I get guests with these big names, ask people. You'd be surprised how, you know. Now, Mike Rowe, in all honesty, it took a while to get him on, but there was never any like, well, no, I don't think we're going to do that. It was, yeah, but it's going to take a little time, and it did, probably about 2 months from the time that we asked to the time he was actually on the show. other people have been like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be happy to, you know, and they, a lot of people, they like doing that. They like talking and interacting with people. And, you know, a lot of them aren't going to sit there and say, well, how many downloads did your podcast get? You know, or anything like that. They're not going to ask that. They may ask, what do you want to talk about? And, you know, that's it. Well, I mean.
Yeah. Jay, we're going a little far afield here on this question.
Well, I know, but
how do you deal with abuse from your friends and family?
I know, but I thought it was necessary to throw that out there. We won't have to continue at this point.
I think I really just want to talk now.
Well, fine.
But I don't actually have much different to say from what Jay has said, though. I do have a rather large extended family who primarily do not listen to the show. My dad listens religiously, for which I thank him, and he will often provide his reactions, his critiques. So I enjoy that. Although we don't really differ too much politically, you know, he grew up in the 60s and 70s, so he's got that working against him. But no, you know, honestly, when it comes to getting abuse, you know, doesn't really happen from friends, doesn't really happen from family. I find more often than not, people will just slowly fade away because they don't want to have that kind of outburst or that kind of conversation with someone like me who might react in a way that would be unpleasant. I don't know, but you never know. So basically nothing happens. There's no explosion of violence or anger. It just kind of fades away.
Sorry, Rono, there's no exciting stories here to tell about, you know, family fights or anything like that, unfortunately. All right, let's move along. Adam, and you'll like this question, Neil, because this is about bourbon. So Adam asked Neil and Jay too, like, oh yeah, that other guy. What is your all-time favorite bourbon? And as a follow-up, what would you choose as an everyday bourbon?
Well, I mean, this question is very good for asking it in a two-pronged way, because my all-time favorite bourbon, which I've tried, is the 20-year-old Pappy Van Winkle. It lives up to the hype, folks. It's heaven. It's so rich and complex and smooth and sweet and everything a bourbon should be. So that is my favorite bourbon. I'm fortunate enough to possess a bottle, and I am very, very slowly making my way through it. I only break it out for special occasions, such as when a friend of mine has a baby or something along those lines. So, but the follow-up, what would I choose as an everyday bourbon? I have lately been buying a lot of the Bullet bourbon. I like that. But I really, if I could pick one every day to drink, it would be probably something along the lines of like Russell's Reserve 10-year-old bourbon, or the Bullet 10-year-old. Something about 10-year-old bourbons really just hits me in the right place. The Van Winkle 10-year-old bourbon actually is probably next in line behind the 20-year-old, if you want my honest opinion. Something about them, they work for me. So anything that's aged about 10 years, I'd probably go for. Jay, how about you? Bourbon?
Well, as you know, I'm not the biggest bourbon drinker. In fact, I'm relatively new to it. Scotch has always been something that I've consumed more of, but I do drink Woodford Reserve bourbon, which mm-hmm. I like. I definitely like the last time I think when at CPAC you had Bullet, and I tried that, and I thought it was great. It's a little I don't know if I'm gonna use the word sweeter, but maybe a little bit lighter than Woodford, which you know is really good. But it's, you know, it can be, I don't know, I guess use the word strong, word to use. It's really good where Bullet is a little bit lighter, and I thought it was excellent. In fact, I'm gonna buy some, just to kind of like balance it out from time to time when I do, grab some and sip it. And I have found that over time that I've been drinking more bourbon, I found that I, unlike scotch, which I really like to drink on the rocks if it's available, bourbon I've found I'm more and more enjoying drinking it neat.
Yeah, yeah. If you can find a good bourbon that works, you know, where it, because if you add water or ice or some other mixer, it really, like soda water, it really changes the character of the bourbon. And in fact, I would say anything much beyond a couple of ice cubes is alcohol abuse. but you know, my animating philosophy is always like, just drink what you like, drink how you like it. It doesn't matter as long as you enjoy it. But yeah, it's interesting how bourbon, it can be very different if you put it over ice or if you just add a little bit of ice cold water to it, that can open it up a little bit.
Right.
It's much like a scotch in that way. And then,
right,
you know, you can get a depth of flavor.
Yeah. So. And when Neil is talking about adding a little water, sometimes it's really just a few drops.
It's like a teaspoon. It's not even a teaspoonful. It's like a demi-tasse spoon
full of
ice cold water. So a couple drops, you know, you could just flick it in there and that would do it.
Yep.
But anyway, so moving on.
Okay. This is from,
let me read this one there.
Okay.
Jay.
Go ahead, Neil.
This one's from John. And he says, "Hey guys, appreciate the work you guys do for the show. It's always a great listen." Well, thank you, John. "For your mailbag show, I'd be curious to hear about what got you both interested in politics and conservatism. Who influenced you? When did you realize you were on the right, politically speaking? Keep up the great work, guys." Well, that's a great question, John. Jay, how'd you get your start in being a conservative?
Oh, well, mine is a one heck of a progression. I'm sorry, I'm eating here. You know, I was raised by hippies for the most part. My father was one of those ones on the border. I was from Brooklyn, so he's on that doo-wop side and then, you know, the Bob Dylan kind of hippie side, whereas my mother, full-time, you know, straight-up hippie kind of thing. She actually did the thing where she hitchhiked from New Jersey to California, all that stuff. So politics in my house, obviously, was not very conservative. And I didn't really get into politics until the 92 election. And as somebody who was younger, and so this is why I understand a lot of times why younger people gravitate towards Democrats. I thought Bill Clinton, you know, I had appreciated Bush for what he had done in the Gulf War, but, you know, it didn't seem like things were going well. And so, I voted for Bill Clinton. So I wasn't necessarily a Democrat, but I voted for him in 1992. And it was after he was elected that I got the first taste of politicians being bullshitters. And, you know, Bill Clinton had promised this middle class tax cut. And then he did this thing on TV where he did an address and he said, "I've been working on this as hard as I can, but I can't do it." And so I was like, "Oh, that sucks." Well, then, it was about maybe a year later, year and a half later, 2 years later, I can't remember exactly when it was, when Bob Woodward's book, The Agenda, came out. And The Agenda foretold the lead up to the election and also into the first year when Clinton did his first budget. And essentially what Woodward found out and what he wrote was that the Clinton team pretty much knew they weren't going to be able to do the middle class tax cut even before, you know, they were going to present the actual legislation, you know, that they were going to do their budget blueprint. They knew it the entire time. They basically, it was one of those things where they kind of lied about it. So that got me into a mode of, you know, this is kind of like ridiculous. And then I started reading books. There was a book by Martin Gross called Call for Revolution, and went through it and started talking about how the government just wastes money and all the things that they do and how they're wasting. And that's when it started to shift. And then this is a little bit embarrassing, but I was younger. So the book that actually turned me was a Rush Limbaugh book. See, I told you so. Now, it's amazing that every year since then, this is 1993, pretty much all political books read the same as this particular one. They're all the same. It's all liberals are evil, conservatives are good, this other kind of stuff. But there was something in there that resonated. And that made me change. And then when Republicans won control of Congress in 1994, I was thrilled. And from that point on, I haven't looked back. Now, I was probably a lot more conservative when I was younger, in my late 20s, than I am now. Now I have a little bit more of a libertarian streak. But I mean, so as far as that's what happened. So that's how, when I realized it, who influenced me? You know, early on, it was, you know, Newt Gingrich, who has turned into kind of like a, you know, Newt Gingrich was actually, in 1994, was this guy that was just kind of like completely different from a lot of other politicians, because he would say things, you know, that other politicians didn't say. And I still remember when he carried this big dictionary out, and this is, you know, the Speaker of the House normally doesn't actually go to the floor of the House and make statements, but he did. And this was about the Democrats whining about the budget or whatever that the Republicans were coming up with. And he read the dictionary. He read the definition of the word sophistry on the floor, on the floor of the House. And I just thought it was terrific. So Newt Gingrich early on, as I grew older, William F. Buckley was probably the biggest influence, without a doubt. You know, Buckley was just that guy that I started to read, and I started to think, you know, this guy really gets it. Him and George Will as well. And I know this will probably be like, oh yeah, cuck. You know, of course, Jay the cuck. You know, if any Trump fans are listening, but George Will as well. So that's pretty much it. I mean, there's more to it than that, but we don't take too much time. But so Neil, I'll let you jump in now.
Well, my story is not as long as Jay's, but
because he's not as old as I am.
Well, that is true. In 1992, I was all of 8 years old, so I wasn't quite politically aware. Though in my second grade,
not much straw, has changed.
My second grade straw poll, I did cast a vote for Bill Clinton. Not that it mattered, because I was not. It was not a valid vote. It was voter fraud, I guess. But anyway, so how did I get interested in politics and conservatism? I think I really sort of started following politics as an outgrowth of my emerging Catholic identity. When I was a young man, I realized very early on that I was pro-life, and I found that the political party that offered a home to pro-lifers was the Republicans, by and large. That's where it sort of ended up. But I was not really what you'd call a conservative, just because I never, I think I've always been temperamentally inclined towards pessimism and the long view of humanity, which is a continuing cycle of ruin and rebuilding, meaning that the individual works of man are so much dust and ash, and we should never get too attached to them, which I think is a profoundly conservative point of view. But I don't think I became a typical American conservative until after my first year of college, or no, my first year out of college, in which I went away. I worked for Habitat for Humanity for a year, being a do-gooder, and my supervisor was a retired Army colonel, who started giving me his old issues of National Review. So I started reading National Review and kind of got into that, you know, Buckley mold of the American conservative perspective. Got out of Habitat for Humanity, came home, got a subscription to National Review, and then William F. Buckley immediately died. So one of the first issues of National Review, one of the first issues of National Review I ever received was the William F. Buckley Memorial, edition. So, that also sort of reinforced my pessimistic, conservative worldview, in many ways. So from there, I've sort of just been watching the Republican Party shift towards a more populist I would say less conservative perspective. So primarily my influences, I would say, have been Jesus Christ the Pope, William F. Buckley, and Colonel Mike Taylor, who was my supervisor.
All right. Okay. Next question is from I guess we could say his last name since he put it in there. Holmes LeBrand? Is that how you say his last name?
I believe so. I believe that's also his Twitter account, so he's public.
Okay. So he asked, well, first he says, thank you, gentlemen. The show's fantastic. I very much appreciate the work you're both doing at Red State, BATF, and beyond.
I like he calls BATF work.
So he asked, what is one of the most important things a young, aspiring writer can do to perfect his or her craft?
Well, I'd say, first of all, listen to the episode of the Fifth Estate Show with Kevin Williamson.
Yes.
But you know, more seriously, I would also say, write. That's really the only way you're going to get better at writing is if you write. You write continually, and you try to write something every day. It doesn't have to be meaningful to you. It doesn't have to be anything like that. But write something. And when you're still finding your own voice, consciously emulate some of your favorite writers. Copy their style. Don't copy their words. But actually, a useful exercise may be to simply type out what they have written and kind of get a feel for how the words flow one into the next. And so that helps you sort of develop your voice a bit. Essentially, the most important thing that a young writer can do to perfect your craft is write, and just don't stop. What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, you definitely have to do it. I mean, for some people, it comes more naturally. I am not a gifted writer by any means. This is a process that has taken a long time. I first started writing regularly after the 9/11 attacks, and it's funny, I still go back to the Wayback Machine, archive.org, and look at some of the older stuff that I wrote in the early 2000s, and I just kind of laugh. Hell, I still do that for stuff I wrote just 2 years ago. That really is what Neil said is right. It's like you just have to write a lot, and you've got to be very critical of your own work. That's what is, you know, a lot of people. One of the things that I've found is that people sometimes get upset when you edit their work. They don't like being edited. For me, there's nothing better than having somebody who's a good editor go through your work and say, you know, and put all the changes in there. And I'm not talking about stuff like grammar and punctuation, which is copy editor stuff. They always do that. Talking about structure, how you do certain things, challenging you on points that you may make where they say, well, you need to explain this a little bit better. So that's one thing is, you know, ask people. That's an amazing thing too, is don't be afraid to ask somebody who you like as a writer to ask them if they'll edit something that you've done.
Right. It's a feedback process, right?
Yeah, definitely a feedback process. Also, I would suggest there are certain books that you should read. Not a lot of different ones, but certain ones. What was it? William Zinsser's book on writing well is a great example of a book that you should get. Also, Stephen King's book on writing is absolutely fantastic. There is half of it is kind of biographical, autobiographical, about what he does and how he came to be, and then the rest is his process on what he does, and it's really fascinating to read. You know, but it and be patient. You know, it could take some time. You know, I didn't get a check for something that I wrote until I was 44. 2014, the first article that I wrote where I actually got paid was in the Federalist, and it had to do with Mozilla and the CEO, how he had gotten fired. And now 3 years later, I'm doing it full time. So, but it was 3 years of constantly doing a lot of different work and trying to, you know, and getting, you know, submitting pitches to people and being turned down and being told this isn't good, or saying we're not going to use this, or, you know, listening to critics. You know, critics are going to be out there. They're going to tell you that you suck, even if they didn't read something that you wrote. And you have to deal with that, you know. But, you know, just kind of you got to slog through it and work hard. And like Neil said, write all the time. Yeah. You have to write all the time. That's the whole thing. If you say, I want to be a writer, are you writing anything? No, then you're not a writer.
Essentially, yes.
Basically,
which is,
yeah.
I haven't written anything more substantial than a long Facebook post ridiculing Ted Cruz, so I'm one to talk. But essentially, I've backed off of my writing quite a bit. But when I was, yeah, it was something that you get in, you actually get into a habit of, I need to write. I have to get this out on the page. Yep. And if I don't, I'm going to say it to a coworker or my wife, and my wife is sick of me. I need to put it on the page instead.
So. Right. I mean, it's funny. Ever since I started writing full time, going back to October, this past week, I decided I needed a day to kind of take to myself where I wasn't going to write, where I would just relax, do whatever else, read a book, listen to music, watch a movie, something like that. And it was the first day. It was yesterday. And I got to tell you, it was like when I looked at the clock at one point, it was like kind of like when you were in school and you were just waiting to get out. I look at the clock, it's like 1:30, and I'm sitting there thinking, holy crap, I thought it was like 5. The day dragged. So it's going to take me a little time to get used to it. But after that, otherwise, you know, I'm up 5:30, 6 o'clock looking for stuff to write about because you have to do it. You know.
So next question comes from our good friend, Andrea Ruth. And
she was a guest on the show as well.
Yes, indeed. Also a former guest. Yes. Yep. If this question was good enough to ask during the Gorsuch hearing, it's damn good enough for you both to answer. Would you rather be chased by 1 horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses? I gotta say, if we're just talking being chased, I'm gonna go with 1 horse-sized duck.
Really?
That's one target to keep track of. That's going to be a horse-sized duck. That's a lot of mass to put on 2 spindly little legs. So I'm going to say that thing's probably going to waddle fairly slowly. So I'm going to say I could easily outrun a horse-sized duck. But 100 duck-sized horses? My God. They'd run up on you. They'd swarm you. They'd clip-clop their little tiny hoofs all over your face. You wouldn't survive 100 duck-sized horses. You could fight off 50, 60, 70, but the last 20 would wear you down. They'd bite you. Do you know horses bite? Horses bite. And they would take little tiny nibbles out of your eyes and your nose. They'd get into your mouth. They'd bite your teeth. No, give me 1 horse-sized duck.
They'd bite your teeth?
Yeah, you know how it feels to have your tooth bitten in half?
No, I don't.
Not pleasant.
I can't say that I've experienced that. Sorry.
Picture that, everyone. Picture something biting your tooth so hard that it cracks through your tooth and shears it. And then the nerves in your teeth start screaming. That is what a duck-sized horse will do to you.
Yeah,
Jay?
See, I was, you know, until you actually said your side, I was actually thinking the opposite. Because I'm sitting here thinking ducks, and I'm thinking like little baby yellow ducks, you know. And it's like if horses were that size, I'd just swat them out of the way. But you're right. If we're talking about like a full-size duck, and there's 100 of them, and I mean a full-size, you know, a horse that's the size of a full-size duck, so that's not really that small.
Ducks are not that tiny.
Exactly. So now I'm thinking, okay, if you take a horse and you make it, yeah. First of all, they'd run you down pretty easily. And then you're right. And then they're just like, they like stomp on you to death with these tiny, it's like fire ants. So like think of like, if you ever got bitten by a fire ant, man, it hurts. And that's one ant. So now,
and you know that their hooves are going to be sharpened by, you know, running around on rocks and gravel and that sort of thing.
Exactly. Ugh,
so they're
right.
Going to be razor sharp little hoofs, and you're going to be lacerated.
Yeah, I think you're right. I take my chance with the duck because even if he caught up to you, they don't have any arms. There's not much they could do. They don't have teeth.
What's he going to do?
You could punch him in the face.
Jump on his back. Ride that duck.
All right, so let's see. Where are we at here? I think we got to move. I think that was the last email question.
Let's take it to where do we Twitter? Did
Twitter,
you put something
yeah.
On?
We could do Twitter.
You went to Twitter with this. Okay, let's see what we got.
Let's go down here and keep going. All right, let's see. All right. Here's one. When will Neil's one-on-one interview with Ted Cruz be posted?
Almost certainly never, because Neil will never have a one-on-one interview with Ted Cruz. I have it on very good authority that I am not allowed anywhere near Senator Ted Cruz.
Yeah, it's probably never going to happen.
Never going to happen. And I'm okay with it.
All right. So is Sucker Punch, this is from Sonny Bunch, is Sucker Punch the greatest movie of the last 10 years or just like the third or fourth greatest? I don't even know what movie that is. Who's that with? Do you know what it is?
That's a Zack Snyder movie about the girls who are crazy and they're in an insane asylum, but they think that they're like superheroes or action people.
No wonder I haven't seen it. It's a Zack Snyder movie.
It's true. I got through about 15 to 20 minutes of Sucker Punch on Sonny Bunch's recommendation. And I could not go any further. It was awful. He got me.
I mean, I kind of liked, I liked his remake of Dawn of the Dead, and I kind of like 300, but I don't think I've seen a movie he's done since then that I don't, that I, and when I saw, I was like, I saw this trailer for Justice League, and I was like, ooh, Justice League, and then I'm watching the trailer, and I'm like, as I'm watching, I'm saying, Zack Snyder fucking directed this, didn't he? And before they even showed anything, sure enough, I could just tell it was him, and I was like, forget it, I'm not even going to bother seeing this. I'm an overrated director. It's like, give me a break.
Uh-oh. We got Jay on movies.
I'm just not
got strong opinions on movies,
just
man.
Just not a Snyder fan, so that's all. So, and of course, that's Sonny Bunch trolling at his best.
And he is very good at that.
Have you guys seen Get Out? Surprising that it seems to indict moderate liberals rather than the easy target of typical rural racism. I haven't seen the movie yet. I have heard about it, though. Heard that, where it kind of it makes fun of the white liberal condescension size racism that exists, not the overt, you know, which racism which is usually blamed on conservatives. So I do want to see it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Would see, haven't seen yet.
I will see it. I will.
That's a promise, folks. You heard it here.
Yes. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I like a good horror movie, and this one is really good. There was a big dust-up about how it couldn't get 100% because some guy wrote a review for National Review that was critical of it, and so it sits at 99%. Yeah, so it's just ridiculous. So, all right. Let's see. From Sarah Smith. If Neil isn't on Twitter, does he really exist? If not, is it even possible for a non-existent being to feel bad?
I will only say sad face emoji.
Okay. Brian asks, did rock and roll music destroy the fabric of our society after all? No. That's all I'm saying.
Yes, ultimately it did. It
did not.
It destabilized the social order, led the kids into thinking they could shake their hips and flout convention. And let me just tell you something. When they say that rock and roll is Satan's music, they mean that in the sense that rock and roll is all about defying proper authority. And that is the sort of authority that your parents exert, that your church leaders exert, that politicians exert. Since the advent of rock and roll, the American Republic has faced a series of social and political crises that have been unprecedented in its history, and in fact may indeed prove fatal. So yes, rock and roll music did destroy the fabric of our society and will be responsible for the downfall of the Republic. That being said, it's pretty awesome.
It is. Without a doubt. In fact, we played one of the great rock bands leading into this, and all you non-Beatles fans can go to hell. Okay, I'm going to say that right now. The Beatles are awesome. We played them on this podcast, and that's all there is to it.
Oh, that was the Beatles?
Yeah, the birthday song, yeah.
I didn't know that.
All right. Now you know. All right, do you think any studio will be able to capture the magic of the John Wick franchise in any successful imitation?
I haven't seen John Wick, I'm sorry to say.
Some Russell Michaels. I have seen John Wick. The first one was very good. I haven't seen the second one. The sequel, from what I've been told... people don't like it all that much. They didn't think it was didn't really kind of capture the essence of the first one. But that's usually kind of what happens with sequels. So Let's see. Flip side. This is from Timothy Lewis. Flip side of the Seinfeld question. What show is the most underrated?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's a really hard question to answer because so many shows are underrated. But depending on the category, I mean, I'll just think of the one.
Does it have to be a sitcom or any kind of show?
Let's say any kind of show.
Okay.
Just to really make it difficult. But I will narrow the scope down to the most recent show that I've watched that I think should be more popular, and that is The Expanse on the Sci-Fi Channel. I think it's an excellent science fiction series. It's got a little bit of the hard sci-fi element. It's got some film noir aspects. It's got some space exploration and travel and war. And it's just got everything you want from space. So, The Expanse.
Nice. I don't know. This is kind of tough. Because I usually watch good stuff. The stuff that I watch isn't really underrated, but... Let me see. Let me think here a little bit. It's funny. I don't think I can answer this question. There's nothing that I've really watched that I'm not sure if it's underrated or what. I'm just kind of looking at a list here with some other people. Oh, you know what? You know what is a lot of people haven't seen that's really good. And I actually have to finish watching it. Is The Nick on HBO
with Clive Owen?
Clive Owen, yes. Yes, and it's funny. Last year, I would have said Homeland. Most shows that are on TV or cable or whatever else, they start off strong and they continually start to then they get weak as time goes by, and Homeland for whatever reason actually its best season was last year. Quinn, who's one of the character that emerged as like the leading guy in the show, became one of the most interesting characters on the show since it started. And then it got really boring, and then this season just kind of sucks. But you know, if you haven't watched Homeland, then I would go ahead and watch the first five seasons. I think they're really good. I don't think I don't know if it's underrated, but I don't think it gets probably the accolades that a lot of people think. So, all right, let's move on. We're running out of time here, so we're going to try and kind of get through these a little bit.
Got to get through some of these questions.
All right, so do you enjoy, this is from Joe Kipley, do you enjoy political or non-political topics and guess more? I enjoy the balanced approach.
I'll say that I think I touched on this earlier in the program, is that I enjoy who I'm talking to in the moment because at that moment, that's who I want to talk to and what I want to talk about. And so whether that's political or non-political, I think I enjoy it just about the same.
Yeah.
So
I do like the balance too. It's nice to be able to kind of talk about politics every single week. I think we'd probably get a little burned out if that's all we did.
Yes. It's like my wife only buys one kind of potato chips, and sometimes I have to tell her, please, please get me some barbecue chips. I just want some variety.
All right. Let's see. Blame Big Government asks, predict presidential nominees in 2020 for the major parties, who and why?
I'll do that. Republican will be Mike Pence, and Democrat will be one of the Castro brothers.
One of the Castro brothers. Okay. I'm not even going to go there. I guess Mike Pence, if Trump is either impeached or he decides not to run again, I would think. But
yeah, that's what I'm counting on him just getting bored and being like, you know,
I'm done with this, I think. Yeah.
This isn't as easy as I thought, and I'm just going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was, I didn't get the hashtag, but I did remember seeing it. Somebody had asked, what is your dream guest? And I think it was Ken who asked that. Who was your dream? Do we have a dream guest?
Do we have a dream guest?
I guess the only dream guest that I would have at this point is probably the one guest who has turned us down. I don't even know if I should say his name.
You shouldn't.
I probably won't.
Change their mind.
Yeah, because if he changes his mind or if he hears this and says, oh, well, you know, I was going to do it, asshole, but now forget about it. Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you what. Show.
Here's my dream guest. Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz, your dream guest.
That's my dream guest. I mean, it's actually kind of a nightmare, more so than a dream. But that's who I do, in fact, dream about when I dream about this podcast, is I'm sitting across the mic from Ted Cruz, trying to think of something to say to him.
Something. All right. Okay, so that's going to do it for Twitter questions. And we have time for a couple more here.
Yeah, I've got a couple that were on my Facebook that I can share. Our friend Bruce Carroll, a.k.a. Gay Patriot on Twitter, asks, does Neil wear pants? And in answer to that, Bruce, I will say, not by choice.
There you go.
A lot of questions about my pants, actually. Carla, this one's about both of our pants. Were you guys wearing crisply pressed khaki pants and navy blazers when you talked to the etiquette lady? Because you probably should have been. And yes, when we were talking to Peggy Newfield, I did in fact have on a blue blazer and khakis, though they were not pressed.
Very nice. I didn't. Yeah. Because she knew I was a cretin, so it didn't matter.
It's just not a cretin, just a Yankee.
Yeah, Yankee. All right. So on mine, there is, let's see. Regina Pryor asked, she's got a few questions here.
Let's just go with one.
Yeah. Over the course of this last year, have you had more votes for Sinatra or Martin? Well, Sinatra won easily.
Absolutely.
Easily. I think Neil's had some bad luck until he got to the James Bond thing with Tom Hardy.
Yeah, which I'll notice there. You promptly abandoned after four episodes, Jay. Don't think I didn't notice. The fix is in. Now we're back. Now we're on is Seinfeld overrated territory, which I think is a pretty easy one for you.
Yeah, well, let's see here as well. Okay, she also asked, what was the most thought-provoking interview? Whew, I don't know. That's kind of tough, isn't it?
I would say Chris Arnotti provided a lot of food for thought, a different perspective. I would say it was very difficult. It was very difficult for me to kind of swallow my pride and reach out to Scotty Nell Hughes and talk to her. You know, the inclination is to just avoid people you disagree with. But that was a very positive conversation, which I think gave me a little bit more hope for the future. Yeah, what about you, Jay?
I'm trying to think. Stuart Stevens was excellent. I'm trying to think who else. Who was? Oh man, I'm bad. This is terrible. I'm forgetting his name. Oh, it was Rob Atkerson. Rob is the chief of staff for my congressman, and. So Barry Loudermilk, he's chief of staff for him, and he kind of talked to us about how the process works inside the House and things that they go through and all this other kind of stuff. And it was really, instead of the stuff that you see, you know, on political shows, it was more the day-to-day kind of thing. Like, you know, what do you do and how do you set up meetings and what happens with this? And, you know, they said that, navigating, the whole responsibility of being in Congress it can be so complex that there is actually organizations that help out people, that they bring them in and they give them like primers. Okay. And here's what this is. And here's what this is. So when you hear about this or when somebody says that, that's what this means. So that was really good. So it was, and it was great because Rob's an outsider. He was a small businessman and now he's kind of in the DC culture. So I thought that was a great one. All right.
Excellent. So any more?
Yeah, there's one more here, and this is from Andrea. She put one on Facebook, too. She said, it's reminiscing time. She goes, I want to hear about your earliest memories of interacting with each other on social media.
Oh, good Lord.
This is what I remember. I just remember, I think you probably got retweeted into my timeline. And I went and I remember this and I said, oh, this guy's kind of funny, and you had, of course, your very dry wit that you have. which was something that I thought was interesting. And so I followed you. Of course, found out that later on that I thought you were a lot older than you actually were.
I get that a lot.
Yeah, because the beard, I think, probably did it. So that's really all I remember. And then it just kind of, you know, it's funny. I don't remember much about our interactions between that and the time that I started Pocketful of Liberty. I just knew that you were one of the guys, one of the people that I wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that kind of tracks with my experience, Jay. I literally have no memory of when we first ran across each other. I do remember Pocketful of Liberty and starting that and saying to myself, geez Louise, now this sounds like work. I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's gonna be too great. But it did go very well and led to a lot of good things from there. And you know, one of the things that I most value about our interactions from that point forward is that you sort of carried my ass across the finish line on a number of occasions when I would otherwise have just decided to watch television or retreat into anonymity. And so I do appreciate that little kick in the pants.
Yeah. And Neil had, and it was funny because Neil on Twitter had this way of just annoying people to a degree that I thought was skillful. And so a number of times I asked Neil to write articles for Pocketful of Liberty that I knew would evoke certain reactions. And when he did, it was something to watch.
And the thing is that I was mostly unconscious of how annoying I was to people. And so Jace basically set me up. I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. I'll make that point. Ha ha. This is a funny turn of phrase. People will be amused by this. No, they were insulted by it.
Big time. I never saw libertarians so angry.
Yeah, I have, unfortunately. But just like anything libertarians do, ultimately impotent and fruitless. So there I go again. I mean, I'm sorry. I can't help myself. I don't even realize I'm doing it. I'm getting better.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Sort of. Sort of. Yeah.
Well, we better wrap this
we do.
This thing up, Jay. It's beginning to become self-indulgent, don't you think?
It is. It is. We were actually at an hour. I told you, it shouldn't last longer than 30 minutes.
See, I find when you're talking about yourself, it's very easy to just go on and on and on. So, well, with apologies to our listeners who usually expect less talking about us and more talking about interesting people. If you've made it this far, thanks for hanging with us and thanks for kind of celebrating our first anniversary, our first birthday, however you want to call it. And thanks for being there with us along the way. And we really are doing it for you. And so that's why we love to hear feedback from you, get reviews from you. And hopefully we'll be able to keep this thing going into the future, because it's definitely a lot to talk about.
Yeah, there is a lot of talk, a lot to talk about. We're, you know, we don't want to give any names away because we never want to disappoint. But we're looking at some pretty big guests here if we can kind of pull this all together. You know, we still want to do some more interesting shows that are non-political, and we're looking at guests that can fill those gaps, fill those needs. So yeah, we're really excited about what's coming up. And yeah, thank you to you, the listeners, so much over this past year. It's been insane. I just had no idea that this thing would take off the way that it did, and it's been a hell of a ride, and it's so much fun.
That's for sure. Yeah. That's for sure.
All right. Well, that is going to do it here. So, for Neil Dewing, I am Jay Caruso, and we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.